We can all agree Don McLean is a legend. We all remember American Pie. All the songs after that, we know that he reshaped discussion of music and actually changed our vocabulary from that album and some of the lyrics that came out of the long version of American Pie, which we'll talk about. He has a brand new album that's coming out in the middle of March 2018. The name of the album is Botanical Gardens. It's everything he loved about Don McLean. What you're going to learn in our visit today, which is a two-parter, Don McLean is a bluegrass fan. He loves bluegrass. I would describe him as a banjo-holic. This may be a side you've never known about Don McLean. You're going to enjoy the conversation immensely. You're going to hear a side of Don McLean that probably you never knew. It's a good side. I'm very happy to welcome to Unreal Bluegrass Don McLean. How are you, Don?
I'm doing very, very well today. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to speak to you. I love bluegrass music.
Well, we talked about that a little bit off the air. We're going to get into that because I did some homework on you, Don. But one of the reasons we're contacting each other now is you have a brand new album that's going to come out March 23rd, I think, Botanical Gardens on BMG. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it ain't bluegrass.
No.
And there are definitely some songs on there that somebody could do bluegrass, I'm sure. And this is all new songs that I've written. And BMG is actually going to spend some money on this, so that's wonderful.
That's good.
I'm a big bluegrass fan. You know, I like Reno and Smiley and Flat and Scruggs.
You know, Don, I found these things out kind of a roundabout way as I'm getting ready for this, and I'll bet you that the audience has no idea what's in store for them. We're going to talk about that, but we want to talk about the new album, but you're a banjo player. You're a very good banjo player, by the way, and I wonder why you're not playing it anymore. I've heard your Sail Away Raymond on Homeless Brother. I've heard your tracks on Playing Favorites. There's a lot of good bluegrass stuff on that.
I don't practice enough, and you have to really be committed to it. When I was younger, and I used to do a solo thing, which I did right through the into the mid or late 80s. I always carried the banjo with me, but I don't do enough with it, so that I kind of take with me what I have. I take my own guitar and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I'll put it in the car, you know, if I'm able to drive somewhere and play it on a show or like that. But I do sit with it now in front of the television quite a bit, and I've got most of my moves back pretty good.
You would be surprised, although you probably wouldn't, how many banjo players say the exact same thing, that they noodle in front of a TV, and I don't know what it is.
Well, the thing that I realized is that the world did not need another Pete Seeger or another Earl Scruggs. That there were those two men had done that job very well.
That's a good point.
What they needed was a Don McLean.
That's right.
And so, but what I found out is by staying away from the banjo for a long time, that now when I play it, I actually do things that are really unique. They're my own thing. And yet I have all this other stuff. I'm probably one of the few people left that really knows every move someone like Pete Seeger or Eric Darling made on the banjo. I know everything those guys knew how to do. I mean, the tunings they use, the strums they use, the chord changes, the licks. And I'm going to actually put something like this on YouTube at some point.
Oh, that'd be good.
And really, memorialize what it is that I know about this stuff, because I studied these great players, and they play it in a different way. Earl Scruggs invented everything, so most Scruggs players are really, just shadows of Earl Scruggs.
Right.
Except for Bill Keith, who was a little bit more a chromatic player, and Don Reno, who was a single string work that he did.
Well, you do know your banjo. You definitely know your banjo stuff. Yeah, go ahead.
The folk banjo players had a grab bag of 100 different things that they would do, different strums and different things like that. And So that's what, you know, that's what I know how to do.
Well, the folk, I want to keep reminding myself, we want to talk about botanical gardens, which we're going to, but we're talking about, and I play a banjo too, so I hear everything you're saying is being accurate, and I understand exactly what you mean. Mm-hmm. But there's so much, Bill Keith, you were talking about Pete Seeger, off the air, we talked about Mike Kropp. There were so many great banjo players in the northeast of the country that I don't know that people can really appreciate the density of what was going on
up there. Yeah, they've all kind of gone. I'm telling you, Dave Gard was an amazingly good banjo player, the Kingston Trio, early Kingston Trio. That guy played the most unique things. A guy named Billy Sayer was a phenomenal player.
I remember that name.
I think he lives down south somewhere, and he's in his, I think he may still be alive, still in his 80s. And Frank Hamilton is a wonderful banjoist and multi-instrumentalist. He played a lot of exotic instruments, you know, the bouzouki and things like that. So, yeah, there was a world of people in those days that were truly virtuosos at what they did. And now it's pretty much all scrub style.
It is. But you know what, Don, what I find out happening, and I mentioned this Grey Fox Festival, which is in upstate New York, I see more and more old-style players coming, very young players coming and playing old-style, and they almost all have their own approach to it now. Mm-hmm. And so I think actually the tide may be turning with the younger players.
Yeah, there's a lot of frailers around.
Yeah. There's
a lot of frailers. That's for sure. But what I learned to do, aside from the frailing, you know, was just a whole bunch of little tricks, you know, ways of using the banjo in a song. If your folks out there are interested,
they are.
There's a cut. I'm playing banjo on a Leon Redbone song called Polly Wally Doodle.
Yeah.
And listen to that song sometime, and you'll hear I did some fun stuff on that is just my own kind of thing. I also recorded a bunch of sides with the Clancy Brothers on a Vanguard record. They were doing some of their best songs over again on one of these albums called A Twofer, you know?
Yeah.
And they called me in because I knew some of them, and they wanted. So I often would do studio work, you know, as a banjoist doing that kind of stuff. You know, not scrug style. I can play scrug style, but not. You know, I'm not committed to it like some of these guys out there now. It's so great, man. They're sharp. They're hot. You know, they really are good.
Well, you have your own style. I tell you what, since we're on this track and we're going to come back to all the great stuff on botanical gardens, I promise you that. Sail Away Raymond that you did on Homeless Brother, that the tuning and what you're playing, I've only heard that as a release. George Harrison wrote the tune, and I heard it as a release by Ringo, and other than yours, and it's something wholly different, I think, than maybe what Ringo.
Right, it's a long neck banjo, and I put the capo all the way down to the nuts, so it's wide open, and I invented this style of playing just for that one song. And,
really?
And then a guy named Ralph McDonald, who's one of the great percussionists and a songwriter too, I think, fabulous sideman. I don't know if he's still around, but he did all that stuff. There were birds in there and all these wonderful exotic instruments. And he built up a whole track around the banjo. And that was done live in the studio, me singing and playing, because that was what I did. I was always, you know, way into everything. I'm a live artist, you know, so. But one of the great things I've been enjoying have been the release of these Flat and Scruggs television shows.
Aren't they great? Those old Martha White shows, my gosh.
Oh, man, and, you know, Lester Flatt is one of my very favorite artists. I mean, I love Earl Scruggs, I Flat and Scruggs, but Lester's singing, his style, his guitar playing, the way he has that sort of country guitar playing, and he sticks that lick in there, you know, every with that.
Those little G-rons everywhere, yeah.
But it's with that finger in the first.
Yeah, you're right. I know what you mean.
Finger tick, man.
Yeah.
I've always wondered, what the heck is he doing down there, you know?
And
I wanted to see that show, and I know what he's doing now, but it's...
He sang like he was talking.
He was great.
And he was such a great singer, but it sounded like he was just talking, but he wasn't. It was so easy sounding.
What a singer. What a songwriter.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, we're going to get back to some of those things in a bit if we have time. I will, before we leave here, I cannot talk to Don McLean and not talk about American Pie. I just have to. I'm old enough. I was in high school when it happened, but we'll talk about that in a minute. But let's get to Botanical Gardens, which is the new release coming out. It'll be out in March 23rd, the date I have. The title cut, I think, is kind of an introduction to maybe not what's to come, but there's a reality, or at least an allegory, to Botanical Gardens as far as you're observing life as you walk through this garden. I don't think I'm imagining that.
Well, I realized kind of after I wrote it that it's kind of heaven.
Okay.
You know, some sort of a place that would be like a Shangri-La, or, you know, and that it's an older person walking through, sort of thinking about his life and looking back and then seeing all these families and young people, and then around all these flowers and beautiful birds, and thinking about it, and then all of a sudden, you know, he fantasizes romance and everything, and then all of a sudden the gates are closing.
Yeah.
Do I go back to the world or do I stay?
Yeah.
And that's kind of like a sort of an out of body experience of some sort. I didn't realize it until after I wrote it and then heard it on the record. I said, wait a second, you can see it that way. And then all the songs actually come from that.
Yeah, they do. And that's a good point. The rest of the songs are kind of like a look back at life as this as the singer is, and you are writing these songs. There's little snips and younger pieces and older pieces and little bits and pieces about aging and relationships, which we'll talk about. Let me ask you this: if you hadn't, am I correct that it's been what eight years since you released an album?
You know, I've lost count, but you know, I have so many albums that I didn't really think. You know, I never think at this point. I mean, I'm 72 years old. That there's any great demand for another Don McLean record, because there's probably 40 albums out there if you count best ofs and everything else.
Yeah.
And so, you know.
Well, Don, the reason I ask is not to do a head count as to how many do you have, but what I'm always curious about, over what period of time were the songs on Botanical Gardens written? Did they happen to fall into this theme that is the title cut, or did you write them over a long period of time, or do you even remember when these songs came about?
They started with the first song, and then, you know, sort of led from one thing to the next, you know, and I really didn't, I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't have a record deal. I mean, who does, you know?
Well,
and
music business is not getting any easier.
So I finished, and before I knew it, my guys in Nashville said, well, I'm going to make some tracks of a few of the songs. So The Lucky Guy is a track, and Total Eclipse of the Sun is a track, and then, you know, I think Botanical is a track. And then I worked on changing some of the rhythms and things. I wanted to have a shit that would fit the counter rhythms going against stuff. So I, you know, I went to Nashville, and by the time I had a bunch more songs that were all, you know, in the pocket in terms of the sound I wanted, you know, the theme of the record.
Yeah.
So then we recorded those, you know, with the band in the studio, and then, you know, added strings or this and that, and, you know, and well, before you know it, we had the record done, and I sent it to my agent in England, Paul Charles, and he found that BMG wanted it bad. They loved it.
Good.
And I've even got a follow-up, actually, already in the can of our band and, you know, doing kind of songs that we do, songs I didn't write, but a whole variety of, and they're... And they rock pretty good, you know.
Well, you did a cover of Crying, right?
Yeah, I had a number one around.
Yeah, that was a big mark for you, I think, because it was a.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it was a big surprise for everybody else because most of the singer songwriters were now finished being on the charts because, you know, disco had come in and just obliterated that particular type of music, and here I was coming back, surprising everybody with Castles in the Air, Crying. Mm-hmm. Since I Don't Have You, some of these things.
Yeah. Back to the album then, Don, if we can. Lucky Guy is, to me, one of these memories through this garden where you're clearly back in the 50s, early 60s, as to the way I hear the tune. And if I had any doubt on the very last note, you're back in the doo-wop kind of sound with
totally.
That.
That's a part of me.
I know.
I don't know if you ever heard my version of Since I Don't Have You, but... you should listen to that.
Yeah, the last note is that
record. I'm proud of that record.
So lucky guy, which kind of brings us to, if we talk about American Pie. To me, I just have to say this, Don. I was in high school when that album came out, and when the song came out, and it's a legend. And I don't want to go through all the things you hear all the time about how many sales and the fact that it's all these Hall of Fames and all these other things going on. But what I remember distinctly. American Pie, and I mentioned that because it references the music, not a death of the music, but, you know, the line, it's kind of from that era with Buddy Holly and those people that you would pull on to write Lucky Guy, I think, kind of in that same era. But that song, American Pie, was, as I remember clearly, I was in high school when it came out, there were still top 40 AM stations that played the shorter version. There were what we call deep track stations that played the long ones, and before long, the top 40 AM stations were playing the long version, which
right.
I think that was the first time that it ever happened.
Probably right. Because it was by public demand.
Yes, exactly right.
You know, they went and bought the album and said, oh man, there's a lot more of this song. We want to hear it. But you know, the Beatles and Dylan and all that, they come out with long songs all the time. I didn't think it was any big deal. But it was too long. You know, I mean, these songs, some of them were 5 or 6 minutes. This is 8.5 minutes. I mean, that's really asking a lot of radio to play that.
And yet, Don, it made it to the top 40 radio stations, incredibly.
But, you know, my life is, I don't think about this stuff. You know, I just, right now I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking, yeah, geez, that really was pretty weird. But as I was going along, I was inside of it, so there was this, like the eye of the storm, there was this whirlwind always around me with that song and the album. And, you know, the album, there was a nice BBC documentary that I participated in with the producer of the album, the engineer from the album, several of the very fine musicians who are on the album, and other people. The making of the American Pie album.
Mm.
And that's probably going to turn up on TV
here, good.
You know, around the world. But, you know, the thing about it is when you were in the 1960s, it happened in film and it happened in records. The studio system was brought down, and not that it needed to be brought down, because the studio system was a phenomenal system for a certain kind of result. Very consistently wonderful result, but it was brought down because people wanted to do their own thing. But when you were suddenly you have actors and people like, you know, making movies like Easy Rider, where they're, you know, making it themselves,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, funding it and acting in it and all this other stuff. And same with records, you know, we didn't have songwriters to write the songs, and then the record company puts you with the right studio, and then the producer was part of the record label. That's the studio system. And then, you know, the arranger came in and did the tracks, and the orchestra did the thing. No, I had to come in. I had to figure out what the arrangement was. I had to figure out what I was going to sing. I had to write the song. I had to tell everybody what to do. And then the producer had to find the right studio, and it was, you know, any studio that he wanted, you know. So he was not within the framework of the record company where Capitol used the Capitol Records.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
well, great echo chambers and stuff.
Well, maybe that was the beginning of the end of that. They didn't know what to do with guys like Don McLean and that sort of music.
You know, I'm not sure it was the greatest thing in the world, you know, because in some ways, right now, you really have like a big musical food fight out there. I don't know what's going on.
No, I don't either.
There's no order, and there's no discipline, and there's no songs, you know. Another guy I really like a lot, by the way, I just want to say, is J.D. Crow.
Oh, jeez.
And I like J.D., and I love Jimmy Martin. In fact, the first time I went to Lexington, Kentucky, it was probably 1970, I was 69. I was opening for Steppenwolf.
There you go.
And I used to open for all these hard-ass bands, you know, when I was a kid. And I came into town, and a fellow spotted me, and I don't remember his name now, but he was a very nice guy. He brought me and said, hey, want to come over to my place? You know, I make records, and that was very nice and very friendly. He said, would you like to see J.D. Crow at the Holiday
Inn? Holiday Inn, that's where he lived.
So I went down and watched two shows with this guy, and I said, I never saw anything like it.
Nope.
I mean, what a player. You know, they were hard-ass bluegrass, man. They were really just fantastic.
And he can still do that. He still is just that. Every pick is like a hammer on a string. It's just still like that. He's still like that, and clean as a bell.
He's got a way of attacking the string. It's a claw kind of a thing.
It looks to me like his wrist has been broken in that direction. So it's like a 90-degree angle from his wrist. And because I've tried to do it and it hurts, so I try to back off of that a little bit. But that's neat that you had that experience.
I'm really happy that. You know, there are YouTubes where I can watch these guys play, and sometimes they have these summits, you know, where five or six of them would get together.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's amazing.
It's pretty amazing stuff. I'm going to skip to, on the album, we're back on Botanical Gardens. I'm going to skip to Waving Man only because I will tell you at the beginning of this program, I'm going to play Waving Man at the top of the show, and when we're finished here, I want you to tell me what to end the conversation with. I'm skipping over for a minute Total Eclipse of the Sun, but Waving Man, to me, I knew a waving guy. Did everybody come up and tell you that they knew a waving man?
There's a waving guy in every town.
There has to be.
Oh, yeah. There's waving guys all over. And this happened for about a year, maybe more. Every time I came home, he waved to me. Every time I went out, he waved to me. And one day I thought, this is, you know, just I had to write this song about him. And I fantasized, you know, who he was. He was in a wheelchair in the old age home. Yeah. He was a veteran, of course. And later I found out that he had to go outside because they wouldn't let him smoke. So he went outside to smoke and started digging the people and waving them. And they became, you know, every now and then he'd get a mechanical wheelchair. He'd just take his wheelchair and he'd head on into town, you know, see across the street. And he passed away now, but he got famous in that song. And there's a little YouTube video of him.
So I'll look for that. The guy that I saw going back and forth to college and classes and whatnot, and you see him all the time, and you wave, and after a while you wave to him and you realize he's not a nut, he's just waving. I mean, when you first drive by and you think, holy smokes. So you see him day after day after day, and then one day he wasn't there anymore, and I would drive, and the next day I would come back, he wasn't there, and I stopped and went to the door, and they said he passed away. But you all of a sudden you miss this guy who does nothing but wants to wave to you as you drive by to lift your day a little bit.
Yeah, he just wants to say hi.
Yeah. You know?
He wants to say hi and he wants to say goodbye.
That's right. Always smiling. I had a feeling there was one everywhere. I bet there's a...
I've had stories people come out.
Well, the Total Eclipse of the Sun that I passed over as we're going through these tunes on Botanical Gardens. I don't mean to have to cover all of them, Don, but some of them fit in so well. Total Eclipse of the Sun is one of those. This is a relationship where. There was one of the parties was kind of evil, I think, and bad. There's bad memories, and there's a lot of trauma. I think I listen to it as one of the people is definitely affected by the other one.
Well, it actually happened to me, and it was eclipsed that weekend.
Oh,
it was like July 23rd or something.
Okay.
And that's the day it happened. No, it actually happened.
I was going to ask you if it coincided with the total eclipse, and I thought maybe you used it as an opportunity, but it actually did happen.
No, it actually happened. The whole thing happened. And I was trying to was trying to catch something. I think I did, because you just expressed it very well. This sense of, you know, when you're young and someone hurts you,
mm-hmm.
and then you go on with your life and you have all this success and everything, and one day you turn around and there she is again.
Yeah.
You know?
And you still have that.
And she has that power.
Yeah, exactly. You know? That's exactly it.
Everything. She's working in a, Bloomingdale's, you know, waking up. Dick money, and you're a millionaire, and she's killing you again.
It's still got it. Those are.
She's not even talking to you.
No, Don. Those are the gypsy moths that don't pull up from the flame when you're in that situation.
That's the one I had. I had to get that.
You tell the story well after that, then almost halfway through, not quite. When July comes, it's you know, people use the seasonal calendars and to talk about life, and it's clearly talking about, you know, here we are in July, and I think you referenced we and what we're doing and whatnot, but it's clearly like, okay, life is moving on, and we're maybe halfway there.
Well, it's a funny thing. I have a caretaker that watches one of my properties in Maine, and he's just a real solid down east guy, and we were up at this house, and it was 4th of July. He's very kind of guy who says things very succinctly. You know, he doesn't really waste a lot of words. He says, damnedest thing. He says, 4th of July, and then the summer's over. And I thought to myself, he ruined it for me forever. Every time it's the 4th of July, I think, damn, summer's over. You know? And you think July's only the 4th. You know, you got July, you got August, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But it's over. No, and he's right. Because come the first week of August, they're talking about going back to school.
You're right.
And when it started happening, I thought, like, son of a gun, you know, he's right. You know, no matter how I may be outside of the rhythm of normal life, you know, I still see the television and there's that back to school stuff.
Yeah.
And the summer's over. And so it started making me think about this whole other concept.
Well, it works. It works out well. Now, the next song I will tell you, as I read down, You're All I Ever Had. That to me, Don, I always thought of you as of course, a singer, a songwriter, but a poet maybe buried within all these things. This to me is the poem gem of the album, You're All I Ever Had.
Well, I'm glad you enjoy it.
And I think that
it's
was
one of those songs.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I don't know where it came from. It was just. Yeah, I have these notions once in a while, and I write songs.
Did you ever put together some of your lyrics as a book of poems?
People have mentioned that sometimes.
Really?
I never thought of that. You know, I'm much happier having a music as a delivery system, you know, rather than having them on the page.
We were talking earlier, Don, about, and if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Don McLean, his brand new album, Botanical Gardens, and we're taking different eddies as we go through. We were talking earlier about the American Pie album, which I had a cassette in those days, and of course then the glue comes off and the parts go off and you can't hear it, and I found it again. My favorite song on that album, all of the airplay and awards to Vincent and American Pie they should have, was Empty Chairs.
Well, that's the one Garth Brooks likes.
And I almost can't get over the words, and I just think what an amazing, you know, I would put the tape in just to find that.
The most wonderful, I love, you know, the most wonderful thing about my enjoyment of what I do, and I must tell you that I don't always enjoy what I do. Songwriting is difficult. Performing is difficult. Traveling is difficult. Dealing with record companies is difficult. Dealing with show business is difficult. But what I love is when I've dealt with all that and I'm able to get on stage in front of an audience and sing these songs, it's like I'm able to go into a little movie part of my life. I don't need movies when I write songs the way I want to write.
Okay.
Because it's like a movie.
Yeah, okay.
And words, the power of the English language, to evoke every single thing that you can get from a painting or a film is, to me, the most wonderful part of what I like to do. I like, you know, writing a good hook, and I like writing, you know, an okay line, but that's not what I'm after. I want to get you inside my head. You know, I want to take you inside my world, my head, and you can't do that with a chorus. One of the problems with popular music is it's all, and Clive Davis years and years and years ago said, it's all the hook, it's the hook, it's all the hook. Well, you know, it's not. But now that's ruined songwriting, because, first of all, nobody can write a damn hook worth anything.
Right.
It's just, they think a hook is to say some stupid thing 500 times.
That's right.
And that's not a hook, you know.
You're right, though, on the number. You're right on the 500 part, though.
It's an annoying repetition of something that's not worth hearing.
That's right.
All right?
Yeah.
It's not a hook. A hook is one time you say it once and you want to hear it again. That's the hook, you know. And so they've even missed out on that. I mean, they don't write lyrics and they think they're just putting out, writing a hook, but the hook isn't a hook worth a damn. You know?
You're right. You're right. Well, I think now, I hate to keep going back to this song because we're talking about what's relevant and new, but Empty Chairs, I think the very last words to me is the hook. It winds up being Empty Chairs.
Mm-hmm.
The phrase, isn't that correct? The very last, I haven't heard it in a while, but yeah.
Sure, but the thing about it is that, you know, what's lonelier than, you know, empty chairs with clothes on?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that definitely hooked me.
Nothing, but you see, to me, like, one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. It doesn't say anything to me. But empty chairs with clothes on them says it all.
Yeah.
Because it's a movie. The other thing is a notion. It's two different things. One is film. The other is just a statement. It's totally different.
Yeah. Can you answer a debate in my head? And I don't know that there is an answer specifically, but is Empty Chairs, was that the inspiration for what became another hit somewhere down the road?
The inspiration for what?
For Killing Me Softly.
That's the song that Lori Lieberman heard me sing that caused her to write the poem that was incorporated into the song Killing Me Softly.
Okay, good.
Yes. The song Killing Me Softly is written about her memory of seeing me sing that song.
She wrote, the story is she wrote it on a napkin, and then that's pretty powerful, Don. That's a pretty powerful impact.
Well, again, it's the difference between those two things I just told you.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
You know, one is the loneliest number. It's just a statement. But empty clothes on empty chairs is a movie.
It's a movie. You see it in your head. I see it in my head now.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what I'm after. I don't talk about something in that other way. I try to tell you things that are happening, and you can see it.
Yeah, I think that's a good. I'm glad. Thanks for answering that for me. I heard different versions of. And we're talking to Don McLean about botanical gardens, but there's a lot of stuff to talk to Don about. But I'm coming back, Don. I'm not going to leave it. Finished up that first segment of our conversation about botanical gardens, about music that Don has been involved in singing and writing, and also his amazing career in bluegrass, playing banjo and guitar. We're going to get into that portion of his career more in the second episode. Thanks again, Don McLean, not only still writing great, great music, so much history of the music industry, of how songs work, and he has an absolutely unbridled passion for bluegrass and banjos. And the second portion, honestly, is because he went in so much detail when we got into that area, and he did a little special dedication in memory of one of his good friends from up in the Northeast New York area, Michael Kropp, banjo player many of you may know. We'll get into that next week on Unreal Bluegrass.